Hi, I'm Mike Dilk and you're listening to the Relax Back UK show, the show that explores all kinds of health topics relevant to you, your family and your friends. Each week I talk to expert guests from a range of backgrounds to inform and entertain you. So please do join the Relax Back UK family and stay tuned.
Hi, and thank you for joining me on the Relax Back UK show. Now, life can be dangerous.
If you look at the numbers when you expand that, it's about 16 million people go to an A&E each year. So it's a huge number. And the number one reason for it is falls, trips, bumps. It's everyday life.
I discuss why and what you can do about it with Dominic Grinstead and Richard Horner of MetLife Insurance. Then, have you ever thought of giving blood?
Every time I've given blood, it's been a fantastic experience. And from, you know, the moment you enter to the staff, to the snacks after, it's always been a really easy and quick experience. And I'll be completely honest, I myself was quite scared of needles.
Stephen King from We Donate is keen to get us all donating more. Please do stay tuned for a great show. Thank you. Dominic Grinstead and Richard Horner of MetLife are my first guests. The topic is the dangers of everyday life and the risks that we take daily. They've written a report, the Everyday Risk Report. To start off with, I told them my initial thoughts.
My first thought was you're just trying to put the fear of God into people so that they all rush to you and buy insurance. That's what you're up to, isn't it?
Well, it's a great question. I mean, we are specialists in providing accident and health coverage, and we insure around 400,000 people in the UK for everyday risks. And the statistics tell us that of those 400,000, on average, around 25,000 claim every year for things like broken bones and short stays to hospital. So we don't want it to be all doom and gloom, because we would encourage people to have a fulsome life, which involves taking a degree of risk. But what we want to do is, should they take a degree of risk and harm come their way, that they're protected in some way. And that's kind of what our business is. We thought we would shine a light on some of those statistics to make people aware of those risks so that they can take an informed decision on whether to take for them or not.
So just run by those figures again. Of the, was it 400,000 clients you've got?
Yeah.
How many are going to make a claim?
Around 25,000 every year.
Okay, so that's quite a high percentage, isn't it?
Yeah, it is quite a high percentage, yes.
And going to say that kind of leads on to a question I had looking at some of your other stats. The stat of one person in three in England had to go to hospital in 2023. I looked at that and I thought, is that really true? I mean, that sounds enormously high. Can that possibly be true?
Well, I was definitely one of them. yes.
I hope you are insured.
I am insured. I'm a policyholder. So the if you look at the numbers when you expand that, it's about 16 million people go to an A&E each year. So it's a huge number. And the number one reason for it is falls, trips, bumps. It's everyday life. So, and I know you rightly say, you know, in protection, it can be called doom and gloom, but the everyday risk report is because what we're looking at is the things that can happen to people every day.
Every day, yeah.
Yeah, it is the clues in the name. Because if you think about, you know, people you know, have they broken a bone? Have they spent 24 hours in hospital? With kids, we cover kids. You know, how many kids go to hospital with broken bones? So those claims, actually, that Dom talked about, 6,200 of them last year were for kids. And it's generally kids being kids, falling off a trampoline, something silly in a soft play. And then for adults, it's hobbies. It's rugby, football, that sort of thing. People doing their job, manual labour. And that's what's driving people into the hospital. So there is a lot of, you know, it happens a lot because there are a lot of people face those everyday risks.
Certainly, when my kids were a bit younger, they often got invited to birthday parties at these trampolining places.
Yeah.
And I think that there was a parking slot outside the trampoline place that was reserved for the ambulance, because it was such a common occurrence.
But, it's,
Trampolines are amongst the worst. They are some really, really bad accidents on trampolines, but kids love them.
Yeah. So is that one of the get-out clauses in your insurance? Or no, do you allow for trampolining?
We actually have no carve-outs whatsoever. So we cover all kids, and we also have an optional extra benefit for those involved in amateur sports as well, which is very, very attractive, where we will pay out additional cover for those involved in amateur sports. We don't cover professionals, but obviously there's a huge number of people who get involved in amateur sports. My son is one of them and ended up in A&E earlier on in the year. So it absolutely does cover those kind of people.
Okay, that's good to know. I mean, because, yeah, getting damaged playing sports has got to be fairly common. What's the most sort of surprising statistic, or the statistic that you thought, goodness me, that's extraordinary, have you come across?
The one from the statistics, actually, about the reasons for people going into hospital. So for about 483,000 were for the falls and trips and bumps, like I said. But the second highest reason for someone going into A&E is poisoning. So 85,283. And I think it's quite broad. It's ingesting all types of substances. But I would never have imagined that would have been the number two reason for people visiting the hospital for A&E.
So this is accidental poisoning. This is not someone trying to bump you off.
Yeah, absolutely.
So is that because so many are such awful cooks? You know, we don't cook the chicken properly, or, you know, it seems amazing.
It could be a range of things. It could be a range of things. I think one of the things we cover in the product as well, it's not just the accident itself, it's the time spent in hospital. Because another stat that I didn't, you know, I wouldn't have necessarily appreciated until we did the research, and we used ONS stats, we used NHS, we used our own stats, was about 1 in 10 of the people who go into hospital is for an accident, but about 3/4 of them actually need further treatment. So it's not just actually the accident where we would pay claims. We pay for each 24-hour stay in hospital. And so for the accidents, you can be claiming for two reasons, which is the accident itself, the broken bone, and then the time in hospital after it recuperating.
And how about time at home recuperating? You know, because if you break your arm badly, you know, and you're a driver, you know, you're out for a while.
Yeah, and that is a driver. A driver is a great example, actually. So driver would be in our top 10 occupations for our policy. So we don't pay for the recuperation at home, but it is about quick cash payments. Most of the claims we pay are within five days, because we're trying to protect people in their everyday. And then within the policy, you've got access 24 hours a day to an online GP service and a wellbeing phone service. So people can phone up and ask questions about that, whether it be legal complications if a driver's had a crash, or mental health issues that they want to go through because they're unable to work. So there are benefits post the accident as well that you can access from the plan.
So we're all having accidents all the time, but are there any sort of accidents that have recently become a little bit more prevalent?
Well, maybe I could just answer that. I mean, you just got to take a look a little bit at how things are changing. So if you're in St. Albans, and certainly if I spend a lot of time in City of London, you can't really move for Uber drivers and Deliveroo folk on their mopeds. And we have definitely seen a large increase in that traditional sort of phrase of couriers, which we thought were kind of, you know, a bygone era. Instead of currying letters now around the City of London, they're currying food around the City of London. So we see a lot of accidents for that type of occupation class. We see a lot of accidents for traditional workers, sort of manual workers, so those involved in forestry, building, etc. That's the kind of thing you would expect. But I would say that the big change has been the number of motorcycle riders in the last sort of 3 to 4 years.
Okay. One statistic that I saw, I thought you might allude to it, but you didn't, so I'll bring it up. Mm. Trips, just simple trips, have gone up apparently 36% in the last decade. I think that's probably from your report, is it?
That's correct, yes.
So what's going on there? I've got a potential idea for that, but have you got any ideas why we're all falling over a lot more?
We'd love to hear your ideas there Mike.
It's not particularly clever. It's just that people are walking along looking at their mobile phones and falling down holes, aren't they?
Yeah. Do you know what? That's as good an explanation as I've got. And it actually makes a lot of sense. There's some logic there.
I mean, it's often, if I'm walking around in town, the number of times I have to get out of people's way because they're walking straight at me looking at their phone. So, yeah, that wouldn't surprise me in the slightest. So a slightly more serious question, I suppose. What am I insuring against? You know, why should I get some insurance? Because I'm thinking, okay, if I work for a large company and I'm looking at my phone and trip up, fall down a hole or something, and I can't go to work for a few days, you know, I'm covered, aren't I? The big company is going to pay me for a few days until I can get back to work. So, you know, what's the bother?
Absolutely. What we would always say is the insurance should always meet someone's need. So if they don't have a need, then they obviously don't take out insurance. There's a kind of a very broad brush to sort of financial planning. The first thing you should do is make sure you have adequate cash savings for those emergency situations. The second thing you should do is be aware of what other benefits you may have. So that might be in the form of travel insurance. It might be in the form of some provision from your employer. You might be lucky enough to work for a very generous employer who will pay you should you not be able to work for whatever reason. But there's a lot of people who are not in that situation. So I'd highlight those who are self-employed. And there is a growing army of self-employed in the UK. The second would be potentially carers. Again, there's a huge number and a growing number of carers in the UK who don't have access to an income, who are generally what we'd class as financially vulnerable. And the third would be families. So if you have children who are in hospital, that can often cause some sort of financial strain as well because you're not able to work. So we would recommend people taking out insurance if they need it.
Okay, well, a fair comment. And you've been through a few examples of how you might need it.
Yeah.
Okay. So what about the amounts? You know, for a regular person with a regular office job, say he does work for a big company, he's got some insurance, he trips over, breaks his leg, is in hospital for 3 days. You know, how much is a broken leg worth?
We actually classified bones as minor and major. So a leg would be a major bone. So you can access the product from £10 up to £50. And for each £10 payment, and it's 10, 20, 50, it's £1,000 per broken bone. So if someone broke both their bones in the lower leg, for example, and they had one unit of cover for £10, we'd be paying out £2,000. And then the hospital stay, it would be £50 for every 24-hour period they pay in hospital. So broken bones, just for a single bone, can go from anything from £250 to £5,000 per bone. But I think it's what Dom covered there really well. It's we know our target market, the customers we'd be looking after are generally self-employed manual workers, and actually a lot of the manual workers who are builders are self-employed as well. Yeah. And if you look across the UK, you know, we know about 48% of people have got less than £1,500 in savings, 20% have got nothing. And our research also told us that in general, for an accident, people perceived they would need £1,200 to recuperate and recover from it. So we know a lot of people don't have that. So the payments we're paying out can be quite significant in terms of how it helps people keep paying their rent, paying their mortgage, sustaining their income if they're self-employed and can't work. So they can really mount up if people break a number of bones and spend a lot of time in hospital. But it can be anything from a £50 claim to, you know, 50,000 plus on one unit of cover.
Yeah, I can see how. Sorry, go on.
Just building on that. I mean, there are some simple claims we pay. You know, you walk down St Albans High Street, you broke your leg, you make a claim, and it's a bit inconvenient, and you can get back to work relatively quickly. But we also pay out some areas of multiple fractures. where people are in hospital for maybe 2-3 months, and those claim payments, you know, become cumulative. So if you have a combination of fractures, you know, it's not untypical for us to pay out claims in the £20,000-£30,000 region for those serious situations. We do come across them, sadly, with sort of motorcyclists, etc. So they definitely are out there.
That was absolutely going to be my question, actually, because we were talking about, you know, a few days where you need some money to sort of get by with the next mortgage payment or whatever it could be. You get better and then you carry on. But so, yeah, my question was going to be, all right, that's okay. There's a lot of people like that, but there's a few people that end up being laid up for months.
Yeah.
And suddenly it becomes really quite serious.
Exactly that. And if they are in hospitals for a prolonged length of time, then we will continue to pay that hospital benefit. And we have had a number of case studies which are really quite, you know, they make us feel quite humble in a way in terms of how the insurance has really helped that family get through a very difficult situation. And by the whole, you know, the whole concept of an accident is you go to work one day not expecting it to happen. And there is a degree of optimism bias that we don't expect it to happen to you. But we know that's not the case. It can happen to anyone. It is by nature very arbitrary. So we do pay out a significant number of pretty serious claims on an annual basis. And these sort of claims payments have been life-changing. And the amount of payment has been really so substantial to the amount of premium paid in, it really has proven a dramatic benefit.
It doesn't sound like a good business to be in. You must be losing money hand over fist.
Well, we are a business. We're still here to make a profit. So I guess what it goes down to, yes, 25,000 out of 400,000 on average would make a claim. But then there are still 375,000 on average each year not making a claim. And of course, that's the whole concept of insurance is you pool your risk. It's the same as car insurance and pet insurance or any other form of insurance. You are pooling that risk to enable the insurance company to pay claims to people who need it when they need it.
Yeah, good point. All right. So if people are listening to this and they've become sufficiently worried or concerned, thinking, hang on, you know, I am self-employed, it would be sensible to just give this some thought. What are some good sources that people can get some information and some general advice from? So, you know, your website as well, but if there are any other independent ones, that'd probably be useful.
Yeah, I would say definitely say our website, but we work with financial advisors across the UK. That's how people access our products. And so seeking out financial advice, and there are, you know, specialist protection financial advisors, that is where we'd recommend to go, because they will take each person on their own merits, look at their family, their loved ones, and make appropriate recommendations for them based on the risks they face. And they do have access to a wide range of products. So it's not just, you know, MetLife products, it's other insurers as well, and it's how they work together to provide full protection to customers. So the most widely bought product in the UK is still life insurance, but life insurance is very, very serious, but we know people are more likely to have those slips and trips. So if you have life insurance with MetLife protecting you for those accidents, you've got that full range of cover protecting you in a wide range of instances.
Good. All right. Useful and somewhat sobering. So, gents, thank you very much indeed for chatting.
Yeah. Be careful out there.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Delightful news, air travelers. Going in and out of airports without getting sick can be challenging. Time to take charge of the air you breathe with Nasal Guard. Nasal Guard topical gel defends by blocking harmful airborne particles and viruses. Try Nasal Guard for air travelers today. Visit Amazon or nasalguard.co.uk to learn more about Nasal Guard spray and gel products. Again, that's nasalguard.co.uk.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, ant and deck. fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries
and cream. A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
Before the next guest, I just want to put in a reminder about the Backup Chair. If you are suffering from a bad back when sitting at your desk and you're in pain, have a look at my website, Relax Back UK. The Backup Chair has helped literally hundreds of people who are suffering from the agonies of back pain, and it may well be able to do the same for you. Now, there's always a need for blood donors. It was recently brought to the forefront with the computer hack at hospitals that affected supply quite badly. I'd speak with Stephen King from We Donate. My first question was, how much blood is needed every day in the UK, and is collection keeping up with demand?
Absolutely. So obviously our background is We Donate, and we're still relatively a new company in terms of kind of what we're trying to do and the mission we're on. But one of the reasons that we actually started We Donate was because we kind of looked into how many blood donors are active and how many are actually giving and how many people sign up and actually end up giving. And, you know, the stats, obviously don't quote me on this, but the stats are around the NHS needs around 200,000 new blood donors a year to fill the deficit. So when you can usually donate between the ages 70 to 65, obviously there's some exceptions, 17 to 65. There's usually some exceptions in terms of being able to donate a bit later. But every year, the kind of NHS, they lose a big portion of their regular donors. So it's really important that there's a new, younger donors coming through the system to fill that deficit, essentially.
Right, because that's just because people that are giving, they get too old to give.
Exactly. Right. You get to a certain age, and then I guess the recommendations usually are between 17 to 65 in terms of donating age.
All right. So this is probably a bit of an unfair question. How many donations a day does that kind of translate into? So if we're losing 200,000 a year, how many have we got, and how much do they actually give every day or per month or whatever we know?
Yeah, really great question. So I think at the moment, especially the blood stocks are quite low. I believe that from the NHS themselves, they say that every one blood donation can save or improve up to three lives, which is incredible. So in terms of kind of daily donations, it really depends, because there's different types of blood. So obviously you've got different blood types. Some are universal, so you can O positive, for example, can be used by other blood types. Others are more rare or sought after because they can't be used for other donors. So it really does depend. It's a moving number, but I think, you know, what the aim is around 10,000 new donors a week. But this is just from my personal research.
that's fine. So, but the point being, there's always a need for more. It's not like, oh, we've got enough, don't worry, we don't need any more. It's always a requirement.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think the main driver behind it is you can store blood and plasma for a certain time period. I believe it's around 30 days and 7 days of plasma. There's always a constant need for a constant supply. So, it's trying to avoid, I suppose, those peaks and troughs, just making sure that there is a steady blood supply.
Now, I've actually given blood myself. Now, this conversation is probably going to provide me with a kick to go ahead and do it again. It was a few months ago. I did it last time, and I was really impressed by the setup. You know, the NHS setup, they swooped into a church hall, everything was there. And while I was there, you know, there were, I think there were at least 8 chairs where you could give blood. Loads of people were coming in. And so I think during the day, they must have had well over 100, maybe 150 donors. And just the whole setup was really slick and really impressive.
Absolutely. Yeah, completely agree. I think it's absolutely fantastic what the NHS Blood and Transplant do. And they truly do it in such a way that it's, really streamlined. Every time I've given blood, it's been a fantastic experience. And from, you know, the moment you enter to the staff, to the snacks after, it's always been a really easy and quick experience. And I'll be completely honest, I myself was quite scared of needles up until my first and second donation. But you know, having that team that are incredible and they really put you at ease and show you how easy it is. And
yeah, they're good. They're just all good at it, aren't they?
That's what exactly. Yeah, they're brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
So when you go to one of these events, how much blood do you actually donate? How much gets taken?
Yeah, really great question. So it's usually one pint, I believe. So one bag of blood, and as I say, the stats behind that are essentially that, you know, every one blood donation can save or improve up to 3 lives, which we think is absolutely incredible, right? So to take, you know, 15 to 20 minutes out of your day, and you could be saving up to 3 people's life, I think is incredible. And that's one of the one of the drivers for us. We just think that's so amazing.
About one pint. So the classic Tony Hancock line of "that's very nearly an armful" is probably about right, isn't it?
Absolutely.
You mentioned that there are different blood types earlier, and some are more useful than others, or some are rarer. Do you know which blood types are kind of more in demand?
Yeah, so I believe at the moment, actually, yeah. So it does fluctuate depending on who's donating and when they're donating. But I believe at the moment there's a call for more O positive and O negative donors. I believe O negative is slightly is rarer, meaning that less of the population have it. But when someone does need it, it's harder to kind of fill those reserves, I believe. It's really interesting. There's always a need for all types of blood, of course, but sometimes it really depends on who is needing it, and the stock level and the demand, essentially.
Yeah. And do you know how much is used, kind of how, because in some instances blood is used as blood and given directly, and in other instances it's made into blood serum?
Really great question. So we usually there's, I think, popping up over the UK, there's more plasma donating facilities too. So you can donate blood and plasma. And what's really interesting about plasma is it's actually used for medicines. So you can use blood medicines for, blood plasma for medicines that can help with the likes of blood cancer. There's other diseases that can be treated, such as sickle cell, with blood donations and plasma donations. So yeah, it really depends, but those are the two main products that are extracted that can be used to help save lives.
This is a slightly technical question, which might be a bit unfair, because I know you're not really a technical guy when it comes to the blood, but when I gave blood, the blood came out of me through a tube into a bottle, and that bottle was being slowly moved. It was on a kind of a machine that made it rock.
Okay.
Do you know why?
Yeah, great. I'll be completely honest with you. I don't know why. No, that was that would be a definitely for someone a little bit more medically qualified, I guess.
I did say it was a bit of an unfair question. So never mind. Because I'm nosy, when I was there, I said to the person who was dealing with the tubes and everything, I said, "Why is that moving?" And he did, and this is, he was the guy on the spot, so there's probably a reasonable chance he knew what he was talking about. He said, "Well, this is to stop, because you know when you cut yourself, the blood clots."
Yeah, absolutely. Clotting
blood is no use. So
there's
something in the bottle to stop the blood clotting, and having the bottle moving slowly mixes it all up and stops it clotting, I think. So anyway,
definitely.
Moving on, what I did notice, apart from the bottle moving around, shaking, the collection bottle moving, was that when I gave blood, there were a lot of people in my age group, and I think I'm probably significantly older than you. I'm 58. or older. And I didn't see that many people who were kind of in their 20s or 30s. Is that kind of a usual thing when people go to donating centres across the country?
No, I think it's a really interesting observation, and actually one of the main reasons behind why me and my co-founder created the idea of We Donate. Essentially, I was a blood donor, and the only time I kind of really became a regular blood donor was when I had a family member that needed blood. And that kind of almost reminded me and drove me to be like, okay, I really should follow through with this and make sure that I book my appointment and go donate blood. So went to donate blood, and that was one of my observations too, was that in the facility there didn't tend to be that many younger donators. So wouldn't say that, but you know, it's quite a interesting observation. And then I guess from there I went away and did some research, and you're absolutely spot on. It looks like from the stats that over the last 5 years, there's been a 50% decline in younger donors, so age 17 to 35. So it is a bit of a problem, it seems, at the moment that you know, people aren't donating as regularly as they used to. And that was one of the issues that we set out to create We Donate to almost hopefully look to help with.
I suppose if you're trying to turn that around, you've got to spend a bit of time trying to think why young people might not be giving. So, you know, have they all become a bit squeamish, a bit scared of needles, or are they just selfish and uncaring, can't be bothered? What's going on?
Really great question. And I think there's obviously multiple reasons behind it, but you know, one of the main ones that I've personally seen from my own research would be, you know, since the move to work from home, it's a lot more it's a lot harder for some people to take a half day off, travel, donate, and then come back. Whereas before, obviously, with everybody working in the offices, it was quite easy to almost donate on your lunch break. Whereas now it's a little bit more tricky to do that. I think other reasons are around kind of the day-to-day distractions that we have now, right? We've got our phones with us all the time, the TikToks, the various bits of bobs, and yeah, I think there's multiple reasons behind it, but it personally, from what I can see, it seems that there was a little bit of a cultural change with people working from home rather than being in the office. And you know, I know that the mobile centers, donation centers would go to you know, office estates and various bits of bobs, whereas now that's a little bit more tricky. So I think that's probably one of the drivers behind it, but that's just
certainly that was my experience. When I worked in an office, one of those buses would come and park in the car park, and yeah, you know, it was dead easy. It took 20 minutes and you know, it was really absolutely no problem at all. So if there's less of that going on, I can imagine the numbers going down.
For absolutely, sure. I think it's more so those vans and those mobile stations still doing an incredible job and absolutely amazing, but I suppose the issue is there isn't that congregation of people in the office. So it's if people are working from home, it's really hard to kind of create that demand in a certain area.
Well actually one of the things I do remember from that bus, and actually you're always giving blood, there are an awful lot of forms to fill in. And in the bus, I remember, because it's quite small, and you're kind of quite close to all your colleagues who are giving blood. So you go in and you sort of turn left and you have a quiet chat with a member of staff and filling in the forms. And the forms are quite detailed, and some of them are things that are quite personal sort of things. Now, it's like, have you recently injected drugs or had sex with prostitutes, all this kind of thing. And one of them was, where have you been on holiday recently? And it just so happened that I had recently been to India, you know, and I'd just come back a couple of weeks ago. And because of that, I wasn't allowed to donate. So you then walk past all your colleagues who are waiting. You don't sit down and wait. You then go back out the door. And at that moment, I thought, they're all thinking what have I answered to these questions as to why I can't give blood today? I suspect that was more my issue than the whole system, though.
Sure.
There is an issue.
going to say, Mike. I think it's a really interesting one, but I think I suppose there's an obligation to make sure that you protect the donor themselves and also the recipient of the blood. So I think it's all one of those things that needs to happen, and it's very, very good that it does happen. So I could, yeah, completely see what you say as well.
it's important that yes, I mean, I didn't mind. It didn't worry me that I wasn't not allowed to give blood. And in fact, I would say that's probably a good thing.
Absolutely.
Right now, we've discussed the fact that fewer younger people seem to be giving blood, and you have decided to try and do something about that. So tell us what it is.
Yeah, of course. So as I touched on, I came up with the idea of We Donate around 3 years ago, and that was from my own personal experience of donating blood, seeing how much of a fantastic, an easy process it was. Like whenever I've donated blood, it's just been really good. The staff have been incredible. The facilities are spotless, and it really is quick and easy. And I think it has that perception that it takes a long time to do, and you've got to take almost a day off work. It's not the case at all. So I guess from my point of view, I kind of realized, it's generally not. It's quite easy and really convenient to do. So that kind of drove me to look and think, what are the reasons young people aren't giving blood? And when you look at the stats, it is very scary, because you look at those stats and you think, that could be a big problem for the future if we're not having the younger generation or people coming through filling the deficit when the older generation stop donating. So I had 10 years experience in retail, and my co-founder has 10 to I believe 13 years experience in development. So we came together and we had the idea of, what if we created a platform that is almost a closed member group that in order to join you have to be a verified blood donor, where we link verified blood donors with exclusive offers and discounts at their favorite high street brands, as a way of looping the brands that want to say thank you, you're doing something amazing, to the individuals that are doing something super selfless. I mean, as we say, what they're doing is they're taking time out of their day and they're doing something that is truly a selfless act to try and help others. So we thought it could be a really, really nice way to create a free platform as a thank you to those amazing people. And it's almost and obviously giving one blood donation and saving three lives is absolutely amazing and incredible. And we just thought, maybe we could create a platform that says thank you and gives people that reminder that you are really appreciated, essentially.
So how does it work then? If you give blood a certain number of times, you get a few quid off a new washing machine or something like that?
Sure. So we don't work off donations themselves. So we what we see ourselves as is a platform. We're completely separate from any government body. We're just a complete solo independent business. So when you donate blood, you get a donor card. So what we do is we're a closed member platform. So when you come on to log on, you can create an account. We then verify via your donor card and grant you access to the platform. So you're given access to the platform for around 12 months, where you're able to shop and, I suppose, browse offers and deals and discounts for everyday life. So we've got some supermarkets on there, we've got the likes of Nike on there, we've got New Balance, Goldsmiths, we've got Prep Kitchen, so food and drink and stuff. And yeah, we've got over 150 brands on there that are all really behind supporting such a good cause and saying thank you to the selfless people that do these amazing things and save lives. So yeah, that's what we've been working on in the background. It's still very, very early days, but
give an example maybe of how much someone might be able to save on something if they're a regular blood donor?
Absolutely. So on the platform, for example, we've aggregated, or we spoke to Goldsmiths, so the jewellery and gold brand, and they have given us an exclusive of 15% off for donors. So essentially what that means, if you were going to buy a gold ring online, you'd receive 15% off with the discount code that we provide. So it's some substantial exclusive discounts. So these are ones that you can't Google and find anywhere else online. They're just on the platform. And it really is just a kind of a big thank you. We appreciate, the time that you take to do something amazing. And
how many times do you have to give blood to get this 15% discount?
Great question. So we don't work off a per blood donation. We're a private members club, essentially. So that accepts blood donors. So we ask that you, when you verify, we grant you access for a year. And then once you you're asked then to re-verify again for to show that you're consistently giving back, essentially.
Okay. All right. Yeah. And is it working? You know, are young people signing up and giving blood?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's absolutely working. However, it's very early days at the moment, so we've only really soft launched. The platform is live, it's just soft at the moment, and we're still kind of running through that process with AXA. The AXA Startup Award has just been incredible for us, really giving us that reassurance and mentorship for helping us do a hard launch and take it to market. It's very, very, very early days, but from kind of our positioning with the brands, it seems that the brands are super on board, and it's absolutely amazing, actually, like the amount of I suppose support the brands are giving to these members.
Well, they're interested in shifting some more stuff.
yeah well, absolutely. So I think it's a win-win for everyone.
Okay. You mentioned this competition. Tell us a little bit about that, and also you've been allocated a mentor. Tell us who that is.
Yeah, absolutely. So we entered the AXA Startup Angel competition because we saw it advertised online, actually, and one of the things that really attracted us to it was the fact that you'll get personalized mentorship from other entrepreneurs that have done similar kind of businesses for good in the past, or created a really interesting business concept from the ground up. And I think the challenge with starting any business or any process is the beginning, right? And not knowing what to look out for, how to do stuff properly, and what process to follow.
Fun as well, of course.
Definitely, absolutely. And I think one of the things is, right, there's certain things that are fun to figure out, and then there's certain things that are business critical to make sure that you get correct. So I think for us, you know, it's been incredible. We entered the competition, we were lucky to win out of 500 amazing startups that entered, and we were able to essentially win the prize money, which is great, because it's
which means that actually your startup was a bit more amazing than all the unamazing startups.
Well, I think obviously all amazing, but thank you very much. That's great. But we, so it's meant the world to us, really, because, you know, the team have been amazing. They've been so supportive. We get we get mentors, and it's not just one mentor. We get mentors across, I believe, four or five different businesses that have done really, really well from the ground up. So it's just nice kind of to be part of.
Bosch was a mentor for some. Are you a Bosch helping you? I know they were a mentor Bosch. In this competition.
Absolutely, yeah. So Bosch actually awarded us the prize on the stage, and the guys are incredible, and we're really, really excited to work with them.
They've been on the show. I've interviewed Bosch. I like chatting to them, and they were certainly good fun. So I can imagine them being very useful in giving lots of good advice in the early stages of a business.
Absolutely, and they're very similar to us. I started the business with one of my best friends and co-founders, who's the developer and the genius behind the platform. And obviously, that's two of us starting, and it was two of them. So it seems like a really good kind of fit and opportunity to learn from someone that's done so well in the business world.
And so, as far as the future, how you need to define success? Do you have an idea of how many blood donors you want to sign up, or how many new, a better question, how many new blood donors you want to create?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a brilliant, brilliant question. So we're obviously a solo entity that operates on our own. So for us to track the stats, it would be quite hard. But I think what we would like is just to create a thank you platform, essentially, for members that join, to say, you know, thank you so much, you guys are amazing. For us, that will be ramping as quickly and as fast as possible, essentially. I think for us, the way that we would measure success is the amount of members that join the platform, but also, you know, the blood donating stats that are published every year. It'd be very interesting to see if there is a correlation between more younger donors or more donors in general, right? I think it's not just targeted at young donors, it's targeted at all donors. It's a big, you guys are amazing, essentially, is what we're trying to go for.
you don't think potentially it's a bit of a bribe for something that people should be doing anyway?
No, absolutely. So that's why we don't reward on donation. We don't link it to donating blood. It's just a third party completely separate from NHS, and just a third party platform that is it. Say thank you, people, members, or community space that where they do.
Okay, all right. Now, if people are listening to this and they think that they would like to check you out, as it were,
sure.
There's a website and an app. How do they find it all?
Yeah, absolutely.
How do they get involved, essentially?
Yeah, of course. So we're web-based, and our website is wedonate.io, and that will take you to our website where you can view and have a look around, have a look at some of the brands, and sign up if you are interested. But as I say, we're very early days at the moment. We've still got some bits and bobs to work through. But yeah, I think it's just for us that obviously winning the AXA award has just been a real reassurance that, you know, we are on the right track. We've still got a long way to go and a lot of hoops to jump through, but we're very excited about it.
Good. All right. Well, look, Stephen, good luck with it. It sounds like a very useful thing to be doing. So I wish you well.
Thank you very much, Mike. Really appreciate your time today. Great to talk to you.
Thank you very much to my guests on this week's show, and they were Dominic Grinstead and Richard Horner of MetLife Insurance and Stephen King from We Donate. And a big thank you to you for listening, and have a healthy week until next week.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
If optimizing your health and well-being is on your to-do list, then let Revive Active, Ireland's number one supplement brand, help you put back what life takes out. All-in-one comprehensive formulas created to offer you maximum benefit, whatever stage of life you're at, and with a range that supports everything from immunity, energy, cardiovascular health, joints, cognitive function, menopause, and even beauty. We've got you and your family covered. Premium ingredients packed into a powerful daily sachet. Simply mix with water to activate for a flavorful health drink. Perfect at home or on the go. Revive Active. Available at selected Holland & Barrett stores, Well Pharmacies, and online at Amazon and reviveactive.com. Super supplements for a super you.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens, and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line, Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Thanks for listening to the Relax Back UK show. Join me, Mike Dilk, again next week for more fascinating interviews and chat. If you're listening to the podcast version, please subscribe, like, and share it with your family and friends. And have a healthy week. Until next week.